Welcome back, everyone, for the second session at 11:15.
Thank you, Barbara. And just aren't we lucky that after a great subject of leases, we are now able to discuss the post-implementation review of IFRS 3 business combination. I think if anything, there's so many edges to IFRS 3, and I'm pleased to hand over to Leonardo.
Thank you very much.
To proceed with the presentation, Tom, showing a few of those edges.
Good morning, everybody. This presentation is divided in two parts. The first part is very little, is an update of this project. And the other part is an overview of the request for information that the ISB published at the end of January this year. The main objective of this presentation is to get your feedback on the request for information. We selected in these slides the relevant question for you, and we hope to get your feedback on these questions. If we start from slide four, we have a picture of the status of the project. Now we are starting the phase two of the project. The phase two consists in two outreach events, and one of these outreach events is this meeting, and also to receive comments on the question included in the request for information. At the end of the phase two, we will report to the ISB our feedback, and then we'll decide what to do with IFRS 3. So if you have any concern on IFRS 3 or some improvement to IFRS 3, this is the right moment to speak. The first issue is in slide six of the presentation, and is the definition of a business. This is a very important issue, especially in some industry, and especially for preparers, I think. A business combination is a transaction in which an acquirer obtains control of a business. A business is defined in IFRS 3, and the definition of a business is reported in the slide. IFRS 3 also provides guidance in identifying a business. This is an assessment that sometimes is very difficult to do. It is also very important because the differences in accounting for a business combination with accounting for acquisition of assets are several and are listed in these two boxes in the slide six. For example, the most famous, in a business combination you can recognize goodwill. When you acquire an asset or a group on asset, you cannot recognize goodwill. Our question for you is, in your opinion, there are benefits of having separate accounting treatment for business combination and acquisition of assets?
Okay, interesting question. Who can I handle? Should there be a difference between an asset deal or a stock deal?
Can I ask?
Peter.
Yeah, I think definitely it is a difference because we are buying a running business. But if we buy a setup of assets, that is normally when we create kind of new business or a new something we don't have revenue connected to. So I definitely think it is a difference between buying a company and buying a setup of assets.
Okay, let's clarify this because my impression is that an asset deal is not so much. It could also very well be a running, ongoing company, and it's not so much that you buy a machinery. I know quite a few asset deals where companies were more or less ongoing. That was more like a tax structure to have the selling company pay the tax on the profit of the transaction. Or are we talking about an asset deal where basically the company is in liquidation, or what?
No, compared to investing in assets, you do an investment, you buy a setup of assets. To me, that is something different. Normally, you don't have immediately a revenue connected to it. But if you put it the way you do, I mean, if I buy the inside of a company or if I buy the shares, then of course I don't see any difference.
We're talking about business combinations, so in both cases.
Clarify what we're talking about.
Yeah. what we're concerned about here is, and it features in some industries more than others, where you're buying perhaps a single asset and there's a debate over whether that asset is itself already a business, or whether it's simply going to then be plugged into a business or a business developed. A classic example would be an investment property. So you buy a building, it's already got tenants in it, now who are generating rental income. Does that represent a business already? Or is that just an asset that you have to put your own processes around to turn it into a business? And the difference, as Leo pointed out in the slides, means that if you treat it as a business, then you've got a particular accounting outcome which differs from if you treat it as just being an asset that you're purchasing. And I suppose our question for you to consider, that we're asking through generally in the post-implementation review, is should it matter? If I buy this asset, should it matter that I get a different accounting outcome if there is a business there or if there isn't a business there?
So, Michael, the primary accounting outcome that differs is that if you're buying an asset, you get no goodwill. If you're buying a business, you might have goodwill.
That's the difference number one. And the difference number two, I think, is also worth mentioning, is on deferred tax.
They're in the blue box. All the differences are outlined in the blue boxes. Yeah.
So those are the two biggest differences.
Is there also an obligation difference as well?
Yeah.
So if you're buying something from an administrator or liquidator, you buy the asset free of all encumbrances. When you buy a business, you might find that you've been involved in litigation or something that has come with the business.
Not necessarily, because I think what you're talking about there is when you're buying assets versus where you're buying the stock, let's say, of a bit. Both could be businesses, though.
Yeah.
So I think we're trying to draw a distinction between when you purchase an asset that isn't a business versus when you purchase an asset that is a business.
So for example, let's say you take Michael's hotel example. You can either buy the hotel and assume the mortgage for that hotel, or the seller can put that hotel and its mortgage into a subsidiary and sell you the stock of the subsidiary. Do you think there should be different accounting? Or are they the same event? And if you think the accounting should be the same, should it be accounted for as an asset acquisition or the acquisition of a business?
Following up on Peter's point, shouldn't you not kind of compare this with having three boxes? Because the alternative is, in your hotel example, that I'm basically buying a hotel.
Mm-hmm.
Or I'm building a hotel. So that's why you have three scenarios. You buy the hotel with the mortgage, you buy the hotel in a legal entity, or you start investing to build a hotel, right? So that perhaps those three scenarios should be compared instead of just simply those two.
Okay.
So
that's my question.
The question is, are there currently very clear criteria for distinguishing between an asset acquisition, just buying a building, and buying a asset, a combination, for example, together with the employees, you buy the hotel. I mean,
the question is whether it matters.
Is that already in place? That's already in place.
Yes, it's already operating.
This criteria, the question you raise is, are they clear?
Okay,
and the words are right in front of you in slide six, so I guess you can read them and you can tell us whether you think they're clear.
Well, we would like to know if it makes a difference to you as well, right? When you're looking
obviously.
Jane was.
I'm just full of questions at this stage. It does seem quite a nice idea to try and think about could they be accounted for in the same way. If they were looking at the accounting for an asset acquisition, which is simpler, there's elements of that that perhaps one wouldn't like why do you capitalize acquisition costs, for example? And obviously you could deal with the deferred tax should be recognized, and there should be disclosure requirements. So it raises that sort of question. The goodwill is paying a premium for control. Well, you may well have to do that for your hotel as well. So that's why you'd be determined to get hold of the writs and you pay a lot of money for it. So you're paying So, but also it's supposed to be things like you're buying customer relationships, brands. But I mean, again, that's all in the asset. So I think it's quite a nice idea to try and get it the same, and it might simplify as well the goodwill accounting that's been such a sort of dog's breakfast in IFRS 3. You know, in terms of splitting up the premium to net assets between goodwill and assets, intangibles with a defined life that you then amortise, which has become a very complex, to put it politely.
Okay. So you're in favour of trying to explore whether you could synchronise this?
I'm in favour of exploring it, unless that's just bonkers and that's not part of the agenda.
I was going to just add a little more background as well. About a year or so ago, the Interpretations Committee had looked at this question and done some outreach and some research on the application of the definition of a business in business combinations accounting, and found that it was an area that there was a degree of difficulty in distinguishing when have you got a business and when have you just got assets that don't together form a business. And so we approached the post-implementation review with this knowledge that there is a difficulty here distinguishing. And so one way that we could go and try and address this would be to try and make the definition of a business clearer so that it's easier to apply in practice. But the other route that we wanted to explore, hence the question, is, well, would the other way of doing it would be to remove the differences in accounting between acquiring a business and acquiring assets that don't represent a business, in which case we wouldn't need to define what a business is.
Okay. Let's really narrow down the discussion then. Let's assume, for argument's sake, that there will be a thorough definition that distinguishes buying a building from buying a building with people and employees. Huh? Let's assume we have that in place. And now the question is, do we want to account differently for a asset purchase, asset business purchase, or a stock business purchase?
No. It's not distinguishing between those two. It'd be saying, I've got a building, versus I've got a building with tenants and other, services being provided through that building. And if I was to conclude that the second of those two is a business, then I would be recognising the assets, the different assets that I get, so the contracts plus the building, etc., all at fair value. I'd recognise deferred tax on those, any transaction costs I would expense, and any premium would be recognised as goodwill. Whereas if I just had the building, and maybe there were a couple of other things that I bought along with it, I would allocate the purchase price pro rata to the fair values of each of those assets that I bought. I wouldn't recognise any deferred tax on them. Any transaction costs would be capitalised as part of that. So I'd be accounting for those differently, and yet some of the elements between those two transactions would be the same. I'd have the building in both, or maybe I'd have some other assets that would be the same in both, but there would be different ways of accounting for them, simply because one includes a business, the other one doesn't.
Peter. So just a quick clarification. So the reason, in principle, you would have had goodwill in buying assets, because you're paying more than the net asset, if you're paying more than the net asset value, but then you immediately adjust the net asset value to the purchase price.
That's
okay.
Yeah. But the starting point is that you're paying different prices in the two occasions.
You could well be, yes.
But if you have a market price of the hotel, let's say it's a building, more or less, with a parking lot and these things, that has a market price. If you're paying the same in a business combination, you get more or less the same outcome. Perhaps you even get a badwill that you can take to profit, but that's engineering. But the assumption must be that you are paying different prices when you're buying the business or you're buying the building.
You've managed to, it's fairly easy to do, but you've managed to completely confuse me here. the presumably, if we've got, if this is an this is coming out of the interpretation committee, they've actually got a transaction that, that they're questioning about whether they should be using the business combination or the acquisition accounting. So presumably, we've actually got the same price. And then I'm really struggling with this concept of fair value. So assign the carrying amount, identified assets and liabilities at fair value. Then, so obviously goodwill falls away. And then we've got, how do we do, if it's fair value, are you saying that you then add in the transaction cost, so it's fair value plus the acquisition related costs, and then fair value but not including the deferred tax and deferred liability implications? So I'm really confused as to what that is.
I'll take one example rather than a comparison of two. So if you bought an investment property with tenants already in it, there are differences of view as to whether that represents a business, whether it meets the definition of business. Some people say it doesn't, in which case they would take the amount that they paid and they'd allocate it to the building itself plus any contracts that are running for the tenants that are there. And then they'd also include in that, they would add on the transaction costs, include those. They wouldn't recognize any deferred tax associated with buying those assets. Another person,
But presumably, they would argue that the purchase price was very close to fair value, and they would never recognize goodwill, presumably.
Yes. So they would argue that they've paid basically the sum of the fair values of the building and any sort of inherent fair values in the contracts for the existing tenants. Another person might look at that and say, well, no, there's a business going on here because it's generating rental income already with the contracts that are there. And they would say, right, well, the total amount that I pay, what I do is, first of all, recognize the building at its fair value, assuming no tenants there. I would fair value any of the contracts that are there. I would recognize any deferred tax that arises on the building, for example. I would then, any transaction costs I would expense, and I would compare the total amount that I paid with the total sum of the fair values of these identifiable assets that I've recognized and the deferred tax as well. And that difference, to the extent there is a difference, is my goodwill amount.
Now it's what I'm leading. Presumably there's fair value, there's goodwill there in a lot of these cases. Is that true? Because then we're in the situation where now we've got two different accountings for the same transaction, two different results retained, and that's a serious problem.
And that's why we've got it as the first question, really, that in our post-implementation review. You're absolutely right. There is difference in accounting, and that's certainly what we've observed in practice.
And
essentially the same thing. Yes.
So is it because Jan knocked me way off when he said presumably there's different price, but in fact what we're thinking about is there's the same price, in one case there's goodwill, in one case there isn't.
Yeah.
Is that really what, is that the fact pattern that's causing us a problem?
That's right, yes.
Okay.
Peter.
Well, maybe I'm revealing that the Swedish real estate companies are not following the IFRS. And I answer the following. Because this is a very common situation in Sweden because of tax reasons. We have 22 real estate companies all following the IS 40, and when they are buying and selling property among each other all the time, and among others also. So it's a very transactive, intense market that we have. The real estates are always put into a company for tax reasons, because if they sell the shares, they will be much beneficially treated from a tax perspective than if they sell the real estate. And if I go through all of the company's balance sheets, I cannot see any goodwill at all in this transaction. I cannot see either acquisition-related costs included in the income statements as I can see in industrial companies. So to me, it's quite clear. Either you have chosen a very complicated or poor example, because what I see in reality is that they are actually doing the same kind of accounting, whether they are buying real estate, a building as such, or a company with a building in. So I cannot really see the situation. Goodwill to me is that you buy for something other than you can see a position on the market or something. And that never occurs when you have real estate companies, because all the values are on the buildings, so to speak.
Could they possibly revalue the buildings before the transaction?
Well, maybe. I haven't really digged into it that thoroughly, so I can answer. But that wouldn't
change the accounting of the acquirer if the seller revalued.
There's no goodwill involved.
I think what you've observed is consistent application within that jurisdiction. But what we observe from our outreach is that in different jurisdictions, there are different treatments. And you may have consistency within each jurisdiction, but compare one jurisdiction with another, and we find there's diversity in practice.
So obviously, the Swedish companies are not following the IFRS.
No, we're not making a judgment on that.
Because I'm investigating them.
Where is my lawyer?
Paolo.
Yeah, thank you for giving me my cue talking about different jurisdictions. I thought it might be useful to give you a perspective of the problems we have here. First of all, I mean, in respect to the deferred tax assets, I mean, the way we see it, the way we do it here in Brazil, deferred tax assets and liabilities will not be moved in any case. So in a way, this problem is simplified. And I would say that whenever you're buying assets that in a way might be construed as a business unit, you inherit tax liabilities. So very seldom you see these transactions here of a transfer of assets without a legal entity. And of course, the way we do it here in Brazil is that since goodwill may be in some cases amortized for tax purposes, we have an additional reason for not doing these transactions outside of a special purpose company or a sub like that. So it's the way we see this here, at least the way I would put it in a different way, the way I see it done here in Brazil is that we do not treat this, we do not see that as something comparable with a business combination. It's an asset acquisition, and we try to allocate the goodwill or the plus value, if you will, as a price of the assets so that it can be amortized over time. Depreciated over time instead of amortized.
I think we have to wrap this up because this presentation is so much longer than this. We need to be careful. What is the exact question you want to? Did you get sufficient answer on the question, or?
Thank you.
I don't know. Is it?
I think we can go to the other slide. Otherwise, we cannot.
I think we have to make a selection now. Can you think about which subjects you would like to discuss? Because we cannot. We will not be able to finish the entire presentation.
I think that a very important slide is slide 9. This is the separation of intangible assets for goodwill. When you account for a business combination, you are required to account for the fair value of the asset acquired and the fair value of the liability assumed, but you are also required to account the fair value of intangible assets that normally are not recognized in financial statements. For example, customer relationship or internally generated brands.
Okay. Do we understand that this particular requirement is the culprit of creating all those customer relationship assets on the balance sheet?
Yes.
That you would not generate in-house?
Yes.
Okay.
When you do a business combination.
Yeah.
The question is, for example, no, the fair value of the net asset acquired is 60. And you pay 100.
Yeah.
You have two solutions to say, okay, I simplify it. The difference 40 is goodwill. I don't need other information. Option two, you say, no, the difference is 10 is brands, 10 is customer relationship, 20 is goodwill.
So do you need this split between these intangible assets and goodwill, or you don't need this split?
Who can I give to it? Who can I give to it? Lots of enthusiasm here. Okay, check.
First, my experience as a telecom analyst, I've done a small search on looking at what kind of assets were identified in some business combination buying very similar assets, i.e. mobile operators in Europe. And you could find that the kind of asset was that was identified was sometimes very different from some customer base or customer relations, by the way, sometimes a roaming contract, but all other companies that had roaming contracts were not identified as being an asset. Very strange. And when you go between the split of all these assets, you could see that the value were extremely different in spite of the company being very similar. We have to remember that when this split was introduced in the US with FAS 140, at the beginning they were looking at three criteria: separability, legal right, and an active market. And they removed the third criteria. And for me, the third criteria is completely missing. So it doesn't help me to have this kind of asset, because where is there the market for brands? I have never seen that, never. And the choice you made has consequences of depreciation, amortization, on the so-called impairment test, which are, for me, some significant waste of time. And so this splitting is a good world for me with this kind of assets, which are not traded, is irrelevant. And by the way, it doesn't give me any indication, a real one, should one day this asset be traded. Because I think the allocation is so difficult that even a company that would have made, let's say, a fair and reasonable thing, would take a considerable risk in guessing that.
Osman.
Thanks. So, with regards to the question, is the separate recognition of intangible assets useful? We try and make use of it in our analysis, but we don't find it particularly useful. So I don't think we'd lose a lot if it disappeared or was subsumed into goodwill. And the way that we try and make use of it is despite, I think, what Jack said about inconsistencies, which I think is absolutely right, that people in the same sector tend to have different intangibles, it still gives some indication of the intellectual property and the licenses and what kind of underlying quality of assets that may exist. But what we try and make more use of, I guess, is, and this is more on the goodwill side, is on the disclosures about impairment testing. Now, we know for sure that impairment happens very late in the process, and it's kind of almost, yeah, we knew that was coming. But sometimes in the better companies, the disclosures about what they looked at in terms of doing the impairment testing or considering impairment testing can give useful indications about future cash flows, and we can sometimes use that to compare against our own model of what we're expecting future cash flows to be in a particular sector.
Okay, let's focus here on not on the impairment, on the separation.
Well, I'm trying to focus on whether this recognition of intangible assets is useful. I think it can be useful, but it's not, because of the subjectivity of it, its usefulness is limited. So we wouldn't lose a lot if it was lost.
May I add something to the question, and it relates to observations that Jacques and Osman have made. In a prior life, I did a lot of work advising management buyouts, leverage buyouts. And it was a key objective in many of these transactions to be able to identify as many intangible assets as possible, because in the tax jurisdiction in which I operated in, there were significant benefits associated with identifying the customer lists and such. You could amortize them over a relatively quick period of time and you'd get tax deductions. So if that were the case, would you feel the separation would be beneficial, because in fact there's real cash flow benefits associated with those intangibles as opposed to goodwill, which typically in most jurisdictions is not tax deductible.
But may I actually, because I think we could actually, instead of if is it beneficial, you could ask a question, is the current situation harmful? Does it hamper proper financial analysis? And I think there's a good case of saying it is harmful. Because what do you see? You now you have these customer relationships on the balance sheet, they generate some sort of amortization depreciation charge, and it makes the business appear more capital intensive. You at the same time you look at the capital expenditures and you see a gap between the depreciation and the capital expenditures because you don't need to replace those, and it gives the analyst the impression that the business is underinvested because you do see the capital is not being replaced, and this is a false impression actually, because they don't need to be replaced by CapEx, and it's quite difficult to distinguish easily between those charges because there are intangible charges, intangible assets that do need replacement, like software licenses, and so it gives a false impression about whether the capital expenditures are up to scratch to support the business in the long run. It's indeed, as you say, a way to reduce the amount of goodwill recognized, and there are lots of companies that would not like to have goodwill on the balance sheet because they need to impair that, and if you can get around that by depreciating intangible assets, that's a way to circumvent the hard criterion of goodwill impairment. So I think it is actually harmful, but there may be other opinions on this.
May I answer Pat's question whether it should be interesting to have the amortization if they were tax deductible? And definitely it would be very interesting because it's good for the company, obviously. But also, if I remember correctly, this was a long time ago, at least 10, 15 years ago, the amount of goodwill that you amortized over 40 years was very small because of this. So more or less everything became amortizable and cash effective. So from that perspective, definitely that just increases the value of the company. But let me give you an example of harmful accounting in this respect. A couple of years ago, I came across a company, bought another company, fairly profitable. And in the purchase price allocation, I could see that they ended up in negative goodwill, which of course amazed me because it was profitable companies. So I looked into the purchase price allocation and I could see that the value of customers they had assessed was tremendous. And that created a negative goodwill, which in line with the IFRS was taken to the income statement. And to me that creates a very strange earnings figure if you do like that. However, this is the only case I have come across, but the amounts were substantial and it was actually a bank. So it was under the supervision of the Swedish authorities. So it's not to play with. So I think that gives in an extreme case the difficulties with this concept. The other thing I would like to add is that I have not come across any analyst that actually, and I agree with Osman, a lot of people look at this figure because sometimes it's substantial, a quarter of the total amount or something. And we try to understand what it is. We try to ask the CFO how they have calculated it, and they refer to consultants and stuff like that. So obviously what the next step is to just take away the amortization on the amount. So we kind of equalize all the companies that do very little of this and the companies that do very much of this. And actually the biggest case I have seen come across is tax-driven, I think, and that was the company Ericsson, the telecom equipment manufacturer Ericsson, bought a UK company called Marconi, and they bought actually the assets and did all this calculations and ended up with zero goodwill. Okay, most of it was product rights, which were amortized, and I think because they bought the assets, it was tax-deductible.
It was bust.
Yeah, it was bust, so they bought the assets, yeah.
Okay, and Dan. Dan.
So I guess I just wanted to just answer the question strictly, which, because this is a post-implementation review, is it useful relative to what it was? And I think, well, I agree that valuations of these intangibles are dubious, and if you look at two companies, it's you know, you look at in the same business, you get dramatically different treatments. I think that in and of itself is useful information, right? If you have two companies, one, you know, you have four companies in an industry, three are amortizing these intangibles over a similar period, and you have this one company that's an outlier and is doing it over 50 years when everybody else is doing 10, I think that's informative. So I think when relative to the previous treatment, which is just to throw it all into goodwill, I think it's useful. I would rather see at least what management thinks they paid for, rather than just throw everything into goodwill. I would also argue that I don't really agree that companies would rather put things into intangibles than goodwill because they have to do the impairment. I think they'd much rather have goodwill that could be have an impairment charge that everybody ignores than have amortization of intangibles that weighs on your earnings every quarter for the next 15 years. But I find the disclosures useful because it gives you a sense of A, what management thinks they paid for, and B, you know, what their accounting policies are relative to their competitors.
Okay, so I think Jane. Robert, no, Jane.
Robert. I'm not sure who's.
Robert.
All right. So, Martin, you said it was harmful. I think I disagree with you. I think that
Brazil.
I think that look, what we have is the separation of intangible assets that have dubious and questionable value. To goodwill, which frankly has no value, is useful. It's that simple. So I'm sort of repeating some of the comments we've heard earlier. It's not a lot of value, but it's better than nothing. Jane?
Scattered points. I don't agree that impairment tests are useless. I mean, as a journalist, it's much more exciting to have an impairment. Who said that? Somebody said that. And much more exciting to have an impairment test resulting in a large write-down, as Royal Bank of Scotland has done once again today, and it is more exciting for an investor as well, than to have. What I don't like about amortization is that it's ignored. That's what preparers love it, because you've just got this totally regular amount that goes through the accounts, and that everybody discounts, you know, in their EBITDA or EBITDA, whatever. And what you actually get is a quiet write-down of something that you've overpaid for, instead of a genuine regular assessment, whether it's by fair valuing it or by doing an impairment test, which should genuinely give you some idea as to whether you've kept it or not. So I actually preferred it when goodwill was stuck all on the balance sheet. I thought that was better than the previous, when you had huge amortization. So, you know, Vodafone made the biggest loss in UK corporate history, except it didn't without the amortization, very, very high amortization of management. The other thing is, I'm actually always talking about this. This is not, what I want to think about is the management's just paid X, usually overpaid X for something. How is it going to get a return on that investment? And I want to be able to see, have a proper record of, remind me what they paid for it, and if they pay a premium, sure, it's useful to have a disclosure of why they thought it was worth, you know, paying 70% more than the market price the day before. There could be other ways to do that, actually, rather than pretending that customer relationships have a finite life. Now, I'm sure there are intangible assets that do have a finite life, you know, a 10-year license. The acquired company or acquired assets would have been amortizing those, and one would expect the acquirer to continue to do that. But the current thing, I just think, is I do take the point that it's useful for the company, the acquirer, to attempt to break down and give. But is there a better way to do that? I don't know. I'd rather the goodwill was just stuck on the purchase price was put on the balance sheet, and either it's then fair value, whatever can be fair value can be, or you impairment test.
Aren't you answering, with all due respect, aren't you answering a slightly different question, which is, should we be dealing with, how should we deal with either intangibles or fair value, should they be tested, or should they be amortized? And I think what you're saying is it's better to test them because that forces the spotlight.
It depends. If there were a lot of these things aren't wearing out. I mean, customer relationships and brands hopefully don't wear out, partly because you're doing the marketing spend and the R&D and all the rest of it. Now, there's a different issue as to whether that should be capitalized, or at least you could see that, so that you don't get these enormous, such an enormous gap in the first place between net asset value and the market.
Is it fair to say that we have no information on what's really going on in this, and it's a big black box?
We do have information. We had lots of information. If the target is a quoted company or some other entity about which you have a lot of information, you have a lot of information, and you also know what they paid for it and how they justified it at the time. You know, synergies of X multiplied by Y or something. So,
yeah, okay, synergies of X multiplied by Y. We don't, but then going forward, you know, I think the comment earlier about, you know, the details about the impairment testing are probably the most valuable. But this is, I disagree with you. This is to a large extent a black box.
Well, you could have more details about the impairment. Somebody said earlier there's got some rather good examples of disclosures on impairment tests.
Are we talking about impairment testing and amortizations now?
Well, that's Jane. I think Jane pulled us there. That's where.
Because I have a lot to say about this issue.
Carlos, last comment. Last comment, Carlos.
I think it's useful, and in particular, I think it's very useful when a company, when a significant part of the value applied is related to licenses. Because, you know, some companies, they buy airwaves, they buy, you know, license to use a brand for a certain period of time, and that's why they pay goodwill. So that's very valuable information.
But Carlos, that license would be already on the balance sheet of the acquired company.
Yes.
So you wouldn't need this this particular line in the standard to re.
It may be accounted as it may be accounted with a different value than you are paying for. And if you are buying a license, you are paying for, you know, you're paying a premium to get that license for a certain amount of years. You know that license will wear out over that period of time.
Okay.
It's useful information.
The fair value of the licenses.
Shall
the
we
value
move on?
The value that you paid.
Yeah. Yeah.
Shall we move on to the next subject?
Yeah.
Yes. I think that the next subject should be impairment test of goodwill. This is my proposal. I hope you agree. And so we are in slide 12, 13 and 14. I want to focus on slide 13 and 14. This is an example of the disclosure of impairment test. And so you can see, for example, in slide 13, that companies are required to recognize impairment loss for each cash generating unit and reportable segment. Are also required to disclose the discount rate used. Are also required to use the events that caused the impairment loss, for example, a lower selling price, lower volumes. And if you go in slide 14, we can see they're also required to use the assumption used to calculate the recoverable amount, and also are required to do sensitivity analysis. For example, they can say, if the discount rate increase of 50 basis points, my loss will increase of 1 billion, I don't know. This is an example of impairment test disclosures. Are you happy with this disclosure? You see how we can improve this disclosure? And I'm also assuming that you prefer impairment test to amortization of goodwill. So if you want to also discuss this issue, this is the right moment.
Okay, Shaq.
First, on the last question, I prefer amortization.
Okay.
But when you look at this kind of test, this is very useful. It's quite detailed, but let's be honest, in my life as an analyst, I've never seen such a level of detail. Never.
Never.
And
this is required.
But this is an actual company?
Yes. Okay.
Yeah.
It's an example. We delayed it.
My understanding for the company I follow was that they have at least 50 cash generating units. 50. Would they be able to give me 50 details like that? frankly, I doubt. I would love, because it would be giving you the business plans, in fact. Very helpful to check. But I really doubt I will ever have this for a group. This is helpful. But will I get that? No.
So sorry, you prefer amortization, but yes. The disclosure are helpful.
Yeah, this disclosure would be helpful, but I'm quite sure I will never get that for 50 business units. I'm pretty sure.
That's, shall we, yeah, anyone, Peter?
Anyone but me, you mean?
Anyone but
me. Anyone sensible? If I look at what I see when a company buy another company, and it is a substantial acquisition, the minor ones, no one, but that goes, just goes on, so to speak. But if you have a substantial acquisition, what normally happens is that the analysts, in a telephone conference or directly to the company, try to pin the management to some kind of key ratio in the future, normally the EBIT margin, but sometimes the EBITDA margin. And they followed that EBITDA margin very closely the years after the acquisition to try to spot whether the total group, not only the acquired company, because the companies are very seldom interesting to reveal future information about the acquired company. But for the group as a whole, if it is a substantial acquisition, they present future margins. And the analysts are sticking to those margins very thoroughly. So if it deviates from the estimated margin by 0.2%, the question is immediately raised, what happened with the acquisition and everything. So I think what analysts, at least equity analysts, are most interested in is, of course, what we will not be able to get. And that is the estimate for the acquired company. So we can follow it. But immediately the acquired company will be separated into different business units within the group. So it's not, the CFO will tell us, it's not possible to follow this unit as we go along. So we cannot do these estimates. And we are used to that. But I think that is the only way to come around what I believe also as Jacques is the only solution. And that is to go back to amortization over a fairly reasonable time. Whatever that is. I have other remarks also.
Are there any people in favor of impairment, the impairment model, the current impairment model?
Oh, yeah.
Well, that one, two observations on the point's always made about the supposed lack of timeliness of impairments. And then sometimes people give evidence of suggesting evidence by saying there was a large impairment and there was no share price reaction. That is not the right argument, and Peter will back me up if I need it. But the problem is that a lot of the information that we get through capital markets is available before there is a formal announcement. So I don't think we should kind of suggest there's a lack of timeliness simply because by the day we get the impairment announcement, there is no share price response. So I think that's not the right argument to use. And I'm particularly on the disclosures. I think there's a lot of interesting information there. I see Jacques' point. And I think the particular issue we found when we looked at some of that PPA data is that the CGU type disclosure is a bit difficult. So, yeah. So those are the ones that are, but I think the impairment model works better. I think any arguments about its lack of timeliness in large scale, you know, academic research, there's no evidence that there is a lack of significant lack of timeliness. And in general, you know, financial markets are not going to wait necessarily for the accounting confirmation of something that we've seen already happen.
I'd like to make a comment on impairment as well. Actually, I do favor the impairment model, and that is it gives me an impression how successful the acquisition strategy of a company through history has been. And a goodwill currently is perceived as something, well, you better not have it, but. In the end, goodwill that in 10 years from now still is on the balance sheet may actually provide evidence and credibility to management for a successful acquisition strategy because they did not need to write down it. Indeed, we analysts don't tend to model goodwill. You know, like it's cash neutral. So that's not the purpose of why I'm in favor of goodwill. It's not the modeling. It's indeed evidence of a successful strategy. It's also evidence of how is management with its feet on the ground. Are they still dreaming that the acquisition they did is working out just perfect, or are they realistic and are they honest to their investors, say, well, we did an acquisition and actually we overpaid with the benefit of hindsight, you know, but are they realistic? So it's a write down of goodwill is also an indication of how management is trying to how honest management is trying to put its picture of the company across. So I find goodwill impairment model to be very useful and insightful for, even though it's sometimes too late, but that's valuable to know as well.
Yeah, but you could argue whether using that information, I hesitate to use the word, but from a stewardship perspective or more from a forward-looking valuation or economic decision-making perspective. So
okay,
that's kind of, you can make that, or you can use that to identify the relevance of it.
And I'd like to, there's another reason, and that's let's face it, to create a company that generates lots of cash flow, has a fantastic global footprint, is a major accomplishment. It's something that's a major accomplishment. You could make a parallel with doing 100 meters in 10 seconds running. And would you distinguish between someone who bought a medal on eBay and had at a certain moment in time sufficient cash to be the highest bidder, or would you prefer a company that built all of those cash flows by themselves organically, by maybe going to the shareholder to get capital for some capital expenditures? It's a massive difference for me whether a company built its cash flows itself, or whether they at one point in time had the funds to buy something that grew fast in the past. And the a sizable amount of goodwill on the balance sheet is an indication that some of the nice parts of the company may not have been grown organically, but it's may have been acquired in the past, and that is something qualitatively and but still valuable to know.
We should move around.
Sorry, Carlos.
Yes, I think the information that you get from impairment may be useful. Maybe most of the time it isn't useful, but maybe useful. Amortizing goodwill, I think it just pollutes numbers, because you end up getting, you know, another charge that you don't really know. You know, the criteria will be 30, 50, 40 years, and there is no significance to that. So I prefer the impairment model.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Me? Yeah. Well, I just want to comment upon your example, because I think you actually gave me or stated the reasons that I'm in favor of amortizations. That is, if you try to create the market position yourself, you need to invest in assets, in marketing, in intangibles of different sorts, and that will hit your income statement eventually. Even if you capitalize it, we will amortize on it, so it will hit your income statement. So why take that route, why you can buy a company and get away without any costs at all, other than the very low interest cost today? So I think actually you stated the reason I'm in favor of amortization of goodwill.
Good job.
Going back to impairment test, I'm a telecom analyst, and the telecom sector, if I remember NESMA report, concentrates about 30-40% of the total goodwill amount in Europe. It went through a bubble cycle 15 years ago, and still remains a huge amount of goodwill. Well, some listed companies in Europe I will not give names, of market cap, let's say, of 100. Shareholders' equity, by the way, is 250. Strange. And when you look at the balance sheet, the amount of goodwill is 400. Not impaired. Nobody believes that. Nobody believes that. The impairment test is unrealistic. I mean, just with a DCF, you can prove whatever you want. Whatever you want. I can sell you my dead dog for 1 billion euros with a DCF. Okay? there is a play on word in France. DCF stands usually for discounted cash flows, but in French it can also mean dis-moi combien il te faut. Tell me how much you need. What is that? I mean, and I can prove whatever you want with a DCF. So having the impairment test relying on the DCF is not serious, really. And when I see the telecom sector with the amount of goodwill remaining on the balance sheet 15 years after the bubble, all these impairment tests are not serious.
Okay. Can I ask? Well,
it's an interesting debate, and first is I think we should not mix up the enforcement and auditing issues with the theoretical record. But I accept the point that if we see the effects of not being credible, we also have to question the accounting standard in a way, not only the audit. To me, the question of amortization versus impairment, even if you had started amortizing those intangibles, which period do you think the companies would have selected? And how much would be left on the balance sheet today after amortization compared to your market cap? I think it's only reducing the difference between the market cap of the company and the amount of unamortized or unimpaired goodwill. I agree it would reduce a little bit the difference, but I'm not sure it would really solve the issue. But
can I first go out, please?
First of all, when I look at the result or the how successful that the mergers would be likely, I would look at that EBITDA margin or something like that. And the also that the I prefer amortization because simply that, first of all, intuitively speaking, I believe that the excess profit created by the goodwill will last forever. I do agree that it is very difficult to estimate that the duration of goodwill, but at the same time that the maintaining the certain cash flow estimate forever is also dubious, or that the more the current impairment test, that someone said that the lack of timeliness is a problem, but it's still informative. But the sheer fact that the current impairment test doesn't catch the depletion of goodwill, it suggests that there is some problem here. Maybe we can devise more frequent impairment test, but still, I do doubt this kind of frequent impairment test, actually that we are doing the impairment test every year, but I'm not very sure how successful we can devise more effective impairment test. Even if we amortize the goodwill, if the merger is unsuccessful, we have to impair the goodwill. So, I would say that by amortizing goodwill, that the gap between that what we would actually amortize and the cost or the carrying amount of the entity should become smaller. So in that regard, I believe that the amortization would be more, informative to value the company.
Thank you, Gordo. We have 5 minutes left, and I see Peter, Joost, and Tanya. Shall we?
It's a quick one.
Okay.
I tilt towards impairment, and the question I would have for Jacques in this context: when you compute return on invested capital, what do you do with goodwill? The reason I ask is because, I mean, I go back a long time. I used to talk a lot about economic value added and all that stuff, and they had amortization. This is in the old days when amortization was the regime, and they would add everything back to confront management every time they look at return on capital with decisions they made and sort of gauge whether they made the right decision. So from that perspective, I'm not averse to having that number there because it confronts them with a decision they made, and they need to sort of show performance on that decision.
Tanya before, or
please respond to Sadara's question.
I consider when I have time to make proper calculation, I would amortize the goodwill and treat it as a cost. It's part of the invested capital, and that's the amount was paid. So at one stage it has to be a cost. Money going outside and not being a cost. I mean, so I would treat it up. And I would put to the argument of Philippe, which is related to your question. The key reason why it was the amortization process was removed from the standard was said to be undefined, mm-hmm. period. Mm-hmm. It has been transformed, in fact, in indefinite, let's be honest. Let's be very honest about that, which is not the proper thing. For me, undefined means difficult, more or less. I have the same question, for instance, in the telecom industry when I buy 4G equipment, you know, the new generation of mobile networks. I mean, I have no idea of what will be the obsolescence of the technology, the take-up rate, the capacity, the cost of operating exactly the network. Still, I have to make reasonable choice, guess, let's be honest about what it is, about the depreciation period. I think we should do similar, clever, reasonable, educated guess about what is the depreciation period of a goodwill. Right.
But it's going back to the point where Martijn says, you know, and what Peter followed up with, it's you really sort of fork out a lot of cash and you acquire this big bubble. You haven't built up your business, etc. You fork out a lot of cash, and I'm interested as a shareholder or as, you know, was it a good acquisition? So show me some numbers that you've generated returns on all that cash that you forked out. And from that perspective, I think keeping that number there until an impairment, you know, and we can talk about whether that is, you know, that confronts people a lot more with what they've done.
But for me, the management is also responsible for the capital invested, and the goodwill has been invested.
It's invested, exactly.
It has a cost. It has to be a cost. I mean, it's not even finance. That's real life.
Okay, thank you, Chuck. We still have Tanya.
Sorry.
Tanya, please.
Yes, I would actually absolutely concur with the idea of the economic profit, and I think the fact that we could almost think that impairment is amortization, that's a timing of the recognition of that impairment, if you like. So in some way you could almost argue that amortization is saying that everything depreciates at the same rate, whereas at least I think with impairment, so I am very much in favour of the impairment model, it really is, I think, management's recognition of perhaps there's been a cost that they didn't account for in an acquisition, and therefore they have to recognise that cost. And by doing it, I think, rather than treating all companies with all acquisitions on the same time frame, in other words, amortising goodwill on a regular basis, we at least get to understand that management, I think, as you said, are confronted with, we've paid too much, the goodwill that is sitting on our balance sheet is not real, and we'll have to write that down. And I think that for shareholders, I think, is hugely valuable to have that decision process communicated through that impairment test and recognition.
Thank you. I think this we conclude this session now and head for lunch.
Barbara, can I make a suggestion? And that is, because of the complexity and the comprehensiveness of this topic, can we bring back this topic at the next CMAC meeting just to talk about some of the other
items that we didn't get to today, for example, disclosures, a few others, just for another 15 or 20 minutes. I think
we'll talk about that.
Okay.
Thank you. Yeah. Before we go to lunch, Australia and Brazil, please don't shut off your video conference. I've been asked just to ask you that. We're going to mute our things, and we'll be back in about a little bit over an hour. Yes, and there's a group photo in London for those in London. So before you run away, and we're going to gather outside. We'll go downstairs, and then there will be lunch in the kitchen. And we reconvene at 4:30, but we have a photo first. So
to be clear, we don't get fed until we get the lunch.
Don't get lunch until you have your photos. We'll see you at 1:30 London time. Okay.
Thank you.
Photos now.
I really advise photos now.
And